Well, where do you live?
We used to live on 157th Street on Riverside Drive.
Ora and Eric Zimmer are coming to the next weekend.
Ora and
Eric Zimmer. Rabbi.
Zimmer? Why should I don't know.
From Bar-Ilan?
No, from, I don't know where
he's
from.
See, you told me about your Aunt Siegler.
Yeah, no, but he was the rabbi of 158th Street. There was a shul there.
That he must have taken over. Because Rabbi Weinberg was the and he was the principal of Yeshiva Soloveitchik.
I know that.
And then be that Rabbi Zimmer took over, but by that time I was no longer there.
You want to say a word, please, about the Supreme Court decision? There's nothing to talk about.
I didn't hear anything. What
the Supreme Court decision in America regarding the passport.
Oh, the Zebetsky decision? What did they say? That they're not going to interfere?
The president said
Right. Yeah.
Was it foregone?
Yeah, I mean, I think people expected it, but yeah.
But they passed it correctly.
The Supreme Court has a shita, at least in America, unlike Israel, that they don't interfere in foreign affairs decisions. Unlike the Supreme Court. Yeah, that's the shita of the American Supreme Court.
I guess you're up to date.
Okay, I'll check it out. I wasn't aware that it came. When did it come out? Like yesterday?
No, today. Yeah, 2 days ago.
Okay.
This week.
All right, I'll have to look. Okay.
Please sit down.
Okay, hi everybody. Good evening, and we're continuing our. We just began part of Maseches Sofrim last. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. So what we're going to be looking at is we're going to be looking at a tractate that's called Maseches Sofrim. And Maseches Sofrim, in spite of the word Maseches, which means a Talmudic tractate, is not really from the time of the Gemara. It really dates from the Gaonim. But it does have many quotations from the Bavli and the Yerushalmi and then later editorial content. And it seems to, in a way, capture the minhagim of Eretz Yisrael in the time of the Gaonim. And a lot of these minhagim are virtually extinct, because eventually in the machlokas between Bavel and Eretz Yisrael, who would have halachic supremacy, the Gaonim really emerged victorious. And the old minhagim of Eretz Yisrael were virtually killed, but Maseches Sofrim preserves them. But what is a little difficult is that the Maseches Sofrim itself underwent editorial revision in Bavel. So as a result, some of the minhagim got covered up or redefined, and as a result, you almost have to be a little bit of an archaeologist to try to uncover the original layer.
How dare they?
And, well, the it's interesting. I mean, I don't like to say it. The Gaonim we consider to be great Torah leaders, but they were sometimes quite brutal in trying to destroy the vestiges of the old Eretz Yisrael minhagim. They called them minhagim of burot, of ignorance. Sometimes they would use the phrase, as I mentioned, minhagim shel shmad. They would simply say, I can't blame Eretz Yisrael, they're undergoing forced conversions and religious persecution, and that is why they didn't know the halacha. But I had mentioned that what had happened in the time of the Gaonim as well was, not only were surrounding countries sending their sheilot to Bavel instead of Eretz Yisrael, but even within Eretz Yisrael, many Babylonian communities, people made aliyah. But when they made aliyah, they brought their own minhagei Bavel. And consequently, in many communities during this period, we're talking about the 7th, 8th, 9th century, 10th century, by the 10th century, these minhagim were almost extinct. You had side by side in many kehilot, you had the Eretz Yisrael minhagim and the larger Babylonian congregations. And eventually the Eretz Yisrael minhagim dwindled till they basically became extinct. Now, as I say, by the year 1000, by the kind of the end of the Gaonic period, Bavel had triumphed in this way, but there were still some residual oppositions. So, for example, in Fustat, in Cairo, when the Rambam was living, right, the Rambam was already in the 11th, in the 12th century, side by side with the established Kehila that followed Minhagei Bavel, you had the smaller Kehila that followed Minhagei Eretz Yisrael, and the Rambam was very annoyed. The Rambam constantly tried to stop them as well, because he felt that all of those minhagim were non-halachic. So Masechet Sofrim has many, many things that we still do, and it is considered to be an authoritative halachic guide, but it also records many, many things that you are never going to hear or see anywhere else.
Yeah. Incomprehensible that you can live in the same place as the Rambam and say we don't follow him.
That's correct. There's no prophet in your prophet doesn't get honor in his own city.
How about the Tehillim? Are they closer to Minhag Eretz Yisrael or closer to Minhag Eretz
Yisrael? Well, it depends. There's a big problem. I don't want to call it a problem, but there's a big issue called Kabbalah. Now, the Kabbalah of the Ari kind of developed in the 1500s, much later. And in Teiman, it was very controversial. Most Teimanim accepted the Kabbalah of the Ari. And that changed everything because that put a Kabbalistic orientation. But you did have a group of Teimanim led by Rav Kapach's grandfather, who did not accept the Zohar, and they followed. But the problem is, the Teimanim followed the Masorah of the Rambam. The non-Kabbalistic Teimanim are Rambam people.
Yeah.
So to the degree that the Rambam rejected...
So they weren't cut off, essentially.
They were not cut off, but the thing is that the Rambam himself sometimes follows the Yerushalmi. The Rambam does himself, but other times he was a misnaget to the Minagim.
Prior to the Rambam, and then we'll go back to the
1800s,
I don't know if we have time to look at it, but Gaster makes the point that basically is his proof for the connection between Sfarad and Eretz Yisrael, that the Timanim had no connection with Babel.
Well, I didn't have a chance to look at it, but I'm going to have to check that, because the truth of the matter is, although Teimanim did have a connection to Eretz Yisrael, but Lamaisa, they regarded the Rambam as their posek, and even after the Shulchan Aruch, they continued to regard the Rambam. Oh, yeah, before the Rambam, yeah. But they seem to have abandoned that with the Rambam, because the Rambam became very definitive. Yeah, you know that... for the year of the Rambam, when the Rambam died, in Teiman, they actually changed the Kaddish, when it says, Yiskadal Yiskadash Mei Rava, B'chayechom, no, May Hashem reveal himself, B'chayechom, in your life, U'b'chayei D'chol Beis Yisrael, and it says, U'b'chayei Maran Rav Moshe Ben Maimon. They actually added the Rambam's name to the standard recitation of the Kaddish for that year.
Is there a reason for this attachment?
It seems to be because at some point in the Rambam's life, Teiman was subject to a tremendous Islamic persecution and a forced conversion. That's correct. And the Rambam wrote a letter giving them guidelines and giving them comfort, giving them strength, but also giving them concrete halachic advice. Now, why they initially turned to him, I don't know, because he seems not to have been that well known there until that point. But that letter created... He wrote it to a rabbi in Yemen, sent him to Shaila. Yes. We absolutely... The rabbi wrote it in Arabic, but we have Hebrew translations, sure. There are volumes, the one volume set or a two volume set, called Igrot HaRambam. The rabbi wrote a number of public letters. Igeret Teiman is his most famous. He wrote other letters, Mamar Kiddush Hashem. He actually wrote a letter, interestingly enough, defending his position on Tchiyas HaMesim. It's very interesting. The Rambam is the one that formulated the 13 principles of faith, and his 13th principle is Emunah in resurrection of the dead. And yet, in the Mishnah Torah, he barely mentions resurrection of the dead. In fact, he goes to great lengths to say, Olam Haba is not physical, Olam Haba is spiritual, it is only the soul that matters, the body could decompose, who cares what happens to the body, what is Tchiyas HaMesim, etc. So he was accused by a number of people, among many other controversies he was embroiled in, that he did not believe in physical resurrection. And therefore the Rambam was a heretic in not accepting one of the principles that he himself considered to be fundamental. And he actually had to write a long public letter defending his position and stating, sure, I believe in it. I'm the one that said, it's a fundamental principle. But the truth of the matter is, when all the dust settles, I guess he had to say it was a fundamental principle, but he didn't really give it a lot of respect, so to speak, because he said, resurrection of the dead, all that means is the bodies get resurrected, but then they die afterwards. It's a one-time miracle that God does, like the splitting of the Red Sea, just to demonstrate his might. But the ultimate eternity of reward is only the spiritual survival of the soul. He said there would be no sense and no value in an eternal life of physical pleasure. So in truth, it's hard to know, given his very narrow, pinched definition of Tichiyas HaMesim. It's hard to know what's the big deal, but formally he does include it as an Ikar. But Igeret Teiman cemented a very, very deep relationship, a relationship of love and awe and respect that the Teimoni communities had for the Rambam. Ad Hayom Hazeh, if you're not a Kabbalistic Teimoni, again, the Teiman is split into two big groups. The Rambam is essentially your posek, not the Shulchan Aruch. It is the Rambam. And in defense of themselves, they actually say, we follow what Rav Yosef Cairo says. Rav Yosef Cairo writes in the Shulchan Aruch that he is not intending to replace any established minhagim that kehilot had. He is simply giving you rules if you don't yet have established minhagim. So they say, oh, Maran, the Mechaber, gave us reshut to be machzik in our minhagim. These were our minhagim and the like. So to this day, that is the case. But okay. But be it as it may, so this is Masechet Sofrim. So there's a lot in Masechet Sofrim that's totally familiar. In other words, it represents the halacha that we keep. In fact, there are many quotations which are directly from the Mishnah and the Gemara. They're just quotations from the Mishnah and the Gemara. There's a lot from the Yerushalmi, some of which we do keep, some of which we don't keep, and there's a lot that's totally extinct, that there's no remez at all in any other sources. The Girsa, the text of these, called Minor Masechtot, is very mishubash, very, very messed up. And as I say, the Vilna Gaon attempted to correct these Masechtos with hundreds and hundreds of emendations. So we'll be using the Vilna Gaon, but when there's a deviation, a significant deviation, I'll try to point out where that significant deviation is. Now, the first nine chapters, which we're not doing right now, maybe we'll get to, is essentially the halachos of writing a Sefer Torah. In fact, that's why it's called Maseches Sofrim. It literally was instructions for scribes. And it has all the laws of a Sefer Torah, which are quite interesting and not so widely known by non-Sofrim. It also has many, many what you would call Masoretic lists. Like, how many, you know, small letters are there in the Torah? How many big letters are there? Certain words have nekudot, they have dots over them. So it's really a listing of what you call the orthographic irregularities in the Masoretic text. And the fact that this appears in a product of Eretz Yisrael is actually very, very significant, because although, because of Byzantine persecutions, halachic teaching was very circumscribed, one of the areas that remained strong in Eretz Yisrael was the branch that is called Mesorah. Now, Mesorah today tends to be used, by rabbis who are against innovations. They'll commonly say, oh, you got to follow the Mesorah, the tradition. Rav Schechter uses Mesorah a lot. So he always uses Mesorah. That's kind of the fallback argument when you don't necessarily have detailed halacha. It's against the Mesorah. But technically, Mesorah is not... Well, it refers to that as well. But when I say Mesorah, I'm not referring to following tradition. But Mesorah was the whole branch of Chachma, the whole branch of Jewish study, that focused on the text of Tanakh, on the Nekudos, on the preservation of the text. You have it called... In fact, the biblical text, the Jewish biblical text, is called the Masoretic text. And the people that preserved this text were mainly in Tiberia. And these were families who had almost a hereditary responsibility to maintain the sanctity of the text. And as a result, if you take a Tanakh, Mikros Gedolos, you will see almost unintelligible little notes, and these are called Masoretic notes. In fact, I see in the Christian seminaries, they actually give you, they don't do it in yeshivas, interestingly enough, we ignore the Masorah, but they actually give you a course. You can get English books in how to decipher Masoretic notes, because they use all sorts of Rashi Tevos that you would never imagine. Like, you would have no idea what it is. Kind of a big, big mystery. But essentially, every time there's a word that's a little unusual, there'll be a little circle, And on the side, it'll tell you, this spelling appears in 13 places. And this is where it is. Or if there's a vav in Aaron, it'll say, male ches pamim, you know, chaser kuf gimel pamim, you know, whatever it is. Something like that. And the Masorah appears in two forms. There is what is called the Masorah Ketana, which simply gives you the numbers, how many times this form appears, but it doesn't tell you where it is. And then in the back of some Mikros Gedolos, they'll give you the Masorah Gedola that actually enumerates all of these things. So most of us take it for granted because we just have our text and the like, but the Balei Masorah were the ones who preserved on virtually every word, except the most common words. Every word, even things like how many times does Hashem speak to Moshe and Aaron as opposed to only Moshe, as opposed to only Aaron, they kept a detailed record. And the Rambam says this is the source of the reliability of our Sifrei Torah, our Nevi'im and Kesuvim. And the greatest of the Balei Masorah were a family in Tveria called Ben Asher family. That was the kind of the family name. And the greatest within the family is Aaron Ben Asher. And you will see in scholarly literature that the Masoretic text that we utilize is from Ben Asher. The Rambam is Meyed, that the Rambam put his imprimatur on the Ben Asher Svarim by saying that, again, I'm not sure how the Rambam knew exactly, but the Rambam said that this is the one, this is it. And the Rambam says he himself wrote his own Sefer Torah based on the Ben Asher Sefer. Now, this, in modern years, has given rise to a little bit of a controversy, because it was believed, the Rambam is Meyed, that the Chaf Dalet Sfarim, meaning not just the Torah, but all of the Nevi'im and the Ksuvim of Ben Asher, were maintained in the Kehila of Chalab. Chalab is in Syria, and that's known as Aleppo. That the Aleppo Kehila had a direct Sefer from Ben Asher, and the Rambam said somehow he was able to get a copy and was matik from there. Now, until recently, there actually was in Aleppo, when there was a Jewish community in Aleppo, they actually did maintain, now they only had parts of a Sefer Torah. They didn't, unfortunately, have a complete Sefer Torah, but they did have most of the Nevi'im and some of the Ksuvim, and this was called the Aleppo Codex, and they had a Masorah that this was the Ben Asher, this was part of the Ben Asher Sefer that the Rambam claims to be the most authentic Sefer. Now, we're not sure that that was the case, because it could be something else, but this was the claim of Aleppo, and they kept it under lock and key. They didn't, like, you know, read the Haftarahs from it. But they kept it under lock and key, and once in a while they could show it to you, whatever it was. I think, again, I am forgetting it, I believe it's now in Eretz Yisrael, I think.
Wasn't it damaged in a fire?
It was damaged in a fire, that's what I'm saying. That's why most of the Sefer Torah is gone. Most of the Torah is gone. We have most of the Nevi'im, some of the Ksuvim. Some of it might be stolen. It might still be surfacing around. But what's interesting is that when you look at the Ben Asher, when people finally had access to the Ben Asher, to the supposed Ben Asher Codex, it was not the same in some ways as our Sifrei Torah. So there was a major, major debate within the halachic community. Should we change our Sifrei Torah in light of what we see from the Ben Asher, because there was a Ben Asher, because the Rambam was Meyed, that the Ben Asher was considered to be the right. If you know, Dr. Mordechai Breuer, who is a big expert in Masorah. You know, Tamei Amikra, right? But he was an expert in many things, Parshanut, but his initial field was in Tamim and Masorah and the like. So he was the editor, the textual editor for the Moshe Rav Kook edition of Nach, which is Das Mikra. You know, is it in the back there? Is it back there? No, it's not. Okay, but you know, Das Mikra is the Moshe Rav Kook I wouldn't call it the scientific version, but it's quasi-scientific. It tries to combine traditional interpretation with archaeology and the like. And they say that they used the Masoretic text that Rabbi Breuer put out from the Aleppo Codex. Again, it's not, most of it was not available for Chumash, but for Nevi'im it was. So the question is, do you change a Sefer Torah based on that? So,
how many differences?
Right.
How many differences? Did they identify?
I mean, not that many. I would say around 20, 25.
Spelling?
Yes, spelling. These are not things that change meaning. We're not talking about some mitzvah got taken out of the Torah. You know, we're not talking about...
How does it spell Dhaka?
I don't remember. I mean that is a chiluk that exists even amongst Sefer Torah. Yeah. That's correct. Well, what's interesting is that. You're right. What's interesting is that the Rambam's own shita is. You are Yotze Kriya Satorah even with a Pasul Sefer Torah. According to the Rambam, you actually never have to take out a Sefer Torah. You're Yotze. You're not Mekayim, the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah if it's not kosher, but you're Yotze, but the Yevid. So the Rambam Mishitasa wouldn't have a problem with that. But you're right, like us, I don't know. I don't know what you would do. I mean, L'chaira, well, it depends. No, but it depends. If Kriya Satorah is an obligation of the congregation, not the individual, so if mitzad the congregation it is a valid kriya, you don't have to worry. Right? You don't have to worry about yourself. For the kehila, this is a valid sefer. So some people were really wanting to go gung ho and they wanted to change the Sifrei Torah to correspond with the Aleppo Codex. But as you might guess, the Rov HaPoskim did not want because they said, you know. Yeah, number one, we have a Masorah, and number two, the idea that the Aleppo Codex is automatically the Ben Asher Sefer, that's conjecture. We don't have an automatic proof for that. The Rambam gave validation to the Ben Asher, not to the Aleppo thing. Now, the Rambam did say, in his time, Ben Asher's Sefer was kept in Chalab, which is Aleppo, but you don't know if that's the one. So he says, you can't. That is not enough of a basis to change Sifrei Torah, etc. But that was it. So the point I'm making simply is that Maseches Sofrim, that does not give you, obviously it doesn't reproduce the whole Masoretic text, obviously, then you'd have be much bigger, but it does preserve many, many lists. And this is because of its connection to Chachmei Eretz Yisrael, which indeed the Balei Masorah made these lists and preserved these lists, and they're coming in. Now maybe we'll get to it eventually when we go backwards. Sometimes the list does not agree with our Masoretic text, so that's interesting as well. Sometimes the Gra will change it to correspond. That's a notoriously difficult process. That's why the text of Brachos and Tfilos, even in the Gemara, is notoriously unreliable because copyists would constantly change the text to correspond to the sitter. Mm. And as a result, it is sometimes very difficult to recover what an original text was. Even in the Rambam, same thing. The Rambam attaches the sitter, but the Magi'im just gave themselves freedom to say, no, that's not what we say, so we'll just change it. So now you don't always know what was the Rambam's sitter. Now, alright, so that's the first part of it, and that represents the Chachmei HaMasorah. Interestingly enough, a little bit of a...
Isn't the clock different between a Sephardi Sefer Torah and an Ashkenazi Sefer Torah?
It's processed differently, yeah. But that wouldn't be a psul because the changes would be kosher b'diavad.
Huh? Yeah. Varies between different communities anyway.
Yeah. Now, one thing, just a little bit of trivia, Masorah studies didn't take off that much in the religious Jewish community. We kind of just have our text and we have our text. What do I need to go over the Masoretic notes? Although there's a lot of interesting wisdom there. But it became very popular among Christians and it became popular among apostate Jews who became Christians. So, if you want to know the definitive publication of the complete Masorah, because in most Mikros Gedolos it's bits and pieces, but the complete Masorah taken from many, many manuscripts, all of the notes, so the definitive work was by a man that was born Jewish. His name is Christian David Ginsburg. Christian obviously is an assumed name. He was a Polish Jew who converted to Catholicism and moved to London. And in his four-volume work, it is called The Masorah, it is indeed the most definitive work on the Masorah. He's not the only apostate that got involved. Ginsburg, Christian David Ginsburg, C.D. Ginsburg, 19th century. This is the 19th century. And he is the guy. He's the four volume. Occasionally, in Svarim that are not aware of his background, or maybe they are and don't care, occasionally they will quote you know, Rabbi Ginsburg, Dr. Ginsburg, they'll quote him, but not necessarily knowing what his background is. But he, again, this is the definitive work on the Masorah. I don't know, there seems to be some Yetzer Hara here. I don't know what it is. Maybe this is why they stopped learning Tanakh in yeshivot. It seems to be, go back much earlier. When Bamberg, Daniel Bamberg was the first, he was a guy, but he was the first printer of Jewish books. His printing press was in Sonsin, Italy. Sonsino. Yeah. He did the Talmud. He did the first Chumash in Rashi. I mean, he was the first. Because, listen, there was a good market in Jewish books. You know, to print non-Jewish books made no sense because 95% of the Christian populations were illiterate. There was no market. Jews bought books. So, Mele, you know, if you're a good businessman, you go into Jewish printing. So, Bamberg, who didn't know Hebrew, but Bamberg invested the money, Jewish printing press, he hired a lot of Jews to be his editors, to be his proofreaders, to be his typesetters in those days, and he printed the first Shas, the first everything, first Rambam. It's all the Bamberg edition. In fact, it's so interesting the role that printers or typesetters play even in the Surat Hadaf. Like, you know, why is Tosfos? Okay, Rashi. Okay, you know, Rashi, Tosfos, all of these things. We could have put other commentaries there. Now, maybe Rashi you couldn't because there's nothing like Rashi. But certainly in Tosfos, you could have put the Rashba, you could have put the Ritva, you could have put the Rush. In fact, the Maral actually said they should have put the Rush. He was critical because Tosfos does so much pilpul, and he says it ruins the minds of young children who should be focused more on direct halacha. He says it was a chaval that the printers put Tosfos. Okay, but the printers decided this, or whoever, proofer, somebody decided it, meaning this was not halacha l'moshe m'sinai, what a page of Talmud would look like, and the like. So Bamberg needed a lot of editors, and when Bamberg put out what is called the first rabbinic Bible, that's what we call Mikros Gedolos. And in those days, the commentaries that we have now were not written yet. Kli Yogar or Achayim, they were not there, but he put it in Ramban, Ibn Ezra, Sopurno, and he had these commentaries there. So his editor was a fellow, Yaakov Ben Chaim, Ibn Adoniyo. He was a person, he was the editor. He was the editor of the Mikros Gedolos. He went over the manuscripts. He decided the Masoretic text based on many different versions, which slightly differed from each other. But he also became, converted to Christianity. A number of the people that were involved in this Masorah and the textual studies, they converted. They became apostate. And as a result... Yes. Yes.
They were behind that.
I'm not really sure. But there are three or four more like this. This is a very dangerous branch of study, apparently. I don't know why. I'm not sure. I know why. But this is a phenomenon that happens over and over and over and over again. And that's why in some Mikros Gedolos they keep Yaakov Ben Chaim's introduction. Others, they take it out, they just rip it out. In the standard offsets, they don't even have it, but in some of the older Mikros Gedolos, that's simply a Tanakh with commentaries, called Mikros Gedolos.
What's his last name?
Ibn Adoniyahu, Yaakov Ben Chaim Ibn Adoniyahu, yeah. And there were others as well, and, you know. Yeah, the art school doesn't...
Has there been any cases with the art school community where they...
No, they don't. So far not. Yeah. By the way, you know. Again, I don't want to schmooze too much here. You know that art school is in big trouble. You know, art school is putting out its own Mikros Gedolos, their own edition of Tanakh with the Meforshim, and you know it's typeset nicely, and you know it's, I don't know exactly why there's a need for it, but they're putting out a new art. Yeah, I'm saying, but what's our need for it? Why do I need a new Mikros Gedolos? But you know, but apparently the Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, who was a bit controversial sometimes, writes in his commentary to Vayhi Erev Vayhi Boker that actually instead of understanding the pasuk that day begins from night, we can actually interpret that the halachic day begins from the day. Vayhi Erev meaning the night of the previous day passed, and when it became morning, it is now the fifth day or the sixth day. And he says that there is no hechrech to assume that the night, that the day begins from the night. Yeah. He said, now he says, as a matter of halacha, we of course have to follow it, but textually, the verse does not have to mean that at all. So the article just took it out. They just took out that comment, and they claim it's obvious that this was, they didn't explain, they didn't say that they did. They just figured nobody would notice, but you know, you have Mark Shapiro, you have people that are always watching Artscroll for every deviation. So now this is a big issue where Artscroll is accused of censorship and this and that, and Artscroll has to counter, well, this was a heretical comment, and obviously the Rashbam didn't write it, because the Rashbam would not say heretical comments, so somebody must have put it in. So since we're only printing the Rashbam, we're not printing other people that add heretical comments to the Rashbam, so that's why we took it out, because we have to assume it's not the Rashbam. You know, that's kind of a tenuous argument. So people are attacking our scroll with that, and then they're going back to all the other Mikros Gedolos to see if it's in there or not, because it's been censored a number of times. And then, of course, you know, the other thing Artscroll did, the most egregious example of censorship is to a modern book, Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. It was a great, great Talmud Chacham, Rav Zevin. He died, whatever, 1970s. You know, he lived well into the 20th century, most of the 20th century. So he wrote a classic book, really one of the best books on he wrote many things, Hasidus, but he wrote a book, Mo'adim Bahalacha. Mo'adim Bahalacha is truly, truly a classic book. He brings in alumnus. In other words, if you want to be an instant Talmud Chacham by just getting a quick and clear survey of the, not detailed halachas, but kind of the halachic questions that Rishonim and Achronim debate. There is no sefer as good as this. So at the end, and you know, he has a parak in every Chag. Chag HaMatzos, Sukkot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Chanukah, Lag BaOmer, Tanesim, right? So the last chapter in the book is on the newest of the holidays, which is Yom HaTzmaut. Because Rav Zevin was a great, great Talmud Chacham. In fact, he was the founding editor of the Encyclopedia Talmudis, but he happened to also have been, he was a Chabad. He knew Rav Kook well. He was much younger, but you know, he came to Eretz Yisrael. He was close to Rav Kook, and he was a Zionist. He was Mizrahi. He was all of these different roles. So he put Yom HaTzmaut, Aschalto de Geula, the meaning of Geula, the meaning of a Medina. You know, he read. So Artscroll, because this is a classic book, Artscroll translated the festivals in Halacha in a two-volume work, but they just took out the chapter on Yom HaTzmaut. Now, they didn't say we took out the chapter, they just took it out. So you wouldn't.
Don't have to be allowed to Medina in their sitter.
That's right. Yeah. But that's okay. They can choose what to put into their sitter, what they don't want to put into their sitter. But here they take somebody's work, and they just pull out a chapter because they don't agree with the hashkafa of the mechaber, and they don't even indicate we're taking it out. And so, you know, if you didn't know the Hebrew, you wouldn't have been aware of this. But there were people who were aware of it, and. English, yes, the festivals in Halacha. Great, great book. Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin. Zevin. A great, great, a wonderful writer. His style is wonderful and very clear.
Yeah.
Taking that what? I'll tell you about that in a moment. Yeah, that's a little different. That's the Torah Tamima's biography of the Nitziv. Yeah. So Artscroll basically said this. Listen to what they say. They made the argument that Rav Zevin wrote this article like in 1948 or 1950 or something, and the state of Israel did not develop in the way that religiously it should have developed. So we are confident that if he would be writing today, he would not write this article. We are confident. So, of course, his sons say, well, we're not so confident. In point of fact, the last edition that our father issued was in 1968 or something. And, you know, he said it was fine. You know, he didn't take it out because of whatever ideological conflict. Yeah, so... I don't know what the legalities are. If Artscroll bought the book, I don't know what it is. But now again, I Artscroll does wonderful things. Chas v'shalom, and I don't want to impugn their very, very great accomplishments. But sometimes they just feel if it doesn't fit a certain ideology, they will just take it out no matter what. So these things. Okay, but now to go back to Maseches Sofrim. The last thing we looked at, again, is really the teaching of the Mishnah. There is no particular chiddush here, and that is that Kriyas HaTorah comes into existence on two levels. It is not a Torah requirement, but the initial Kriyas HaTorah is a takana of Moshe Rabbeinu, and that is to read the Torah every Shabbos, and to read it on Yom Tov, and we include in that Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed. It is later Ezra who said there's an obligation to read the Torah Monday, Thursday, and Shabbos Mincha. Right, so they have a two-tiered obligation. And the Monday and Thursday was that people should not go 3 days without hearing the Torah. Monday and Thursday were chosen because they were market days where smaller communities would come to bigger cities. And Shabbos Mincha was chosen to prevent people from hanging around street corners and just shooting the breeze, that there would be a kind of a shiur in the Torah that would be there. Now let me just mention one other thing. I'm going a little ahead of myself, but
Tanesim is also Ezra.
Tanesim seems to be also be Ezra. Yeah. I want to mention something that's recorded a little later on, but it's a fascinating minhag. We know that just as we have a Kriyas HaTorah in Shabbos morning and Yom Tov morning, we also have a Haftorah, right? That Chazal enacted a reading of the prophets that is connected to either the Parsha or the Maftir, if it's a Yom Tov or the like. Now, what is the origin of Haftorah? Now, when I was a child and I first heard the words, I thought, well, the Nevi'im are not as important as the Torah, so maybe Haftorah means half Torah. I thought it was pretty smart, you know, for an 8-year-old. I said, okay, it's called half Torah. That's right. So half Torah lahaftir just means to announce. And initially, a half Torah was not concurrent with the Torah, but rather there was a time around the time of the Hasmonean persecutions, where Jews were not allowed to publicly read the Torah, and they would actually have guards that would ensure the Torah would not be read. So they read the Haftorah to at least have prophetic message connected to the Parsha. And that is why there's a minimum size for Haftorah, although we don't always keep to the minimum. Haftorah is supposed to be at least 21 psukim. Why 21 psukim? Because a minimum Torah reading is 3 psukim per oleh. Now, when you only have... Right, so it's 21, right? So there are 7 olim. So the Haftarah is keneged, it is a surrogate for Kriyas HaTorah. That was the original. However, later, when Baruch Hashem, we were able to resume Kriyas HaTorah, so, you know, in Judaism, we never drop minhagim, we just add. So Mimela, we kept the Haftarah and we kept the Torah reading. So this is the Haftorah. But what is interesting is Maseches Sofrim records the minhag of Eretz Yisrael that just as Shabbos in the morning you had a Haftorah from the Nevi'im, Shabbos Mincha you had a Haftorah from the Kesuvim. They would actually read a passage from the Kesuvim, which is very, very fascinating. I don't think there's any Kehillah that does it. And they would actually recite a Bracha on the Kriya of the Ksuvim. Now, there was no maftir. It's interesting. There never was a maftir, per se, Shabbos Mincha. So presumably it was similar to what we do on a fast day, right? On a fast day, what do we do? Let's say Tisha B'Av. Or Mincha, the fast day. The third Ola gets maftir, right?
So they
don't do what?
They don't have a
yeah. But Maseches Sofrim does say there's a Haftorah for Mincha. That was the minhag of Eretz Yisrael. And therefore we would have to assume that they did the same thing at Mincha with Ksuvim.
But they don't have a Mizrach after Hapa to say two Pirkei Teilim. Or the Yom.
By Mincha.
They don't have a Mizrach, say a Pirkei Teilim.
That's very...
Huh?
No, but that's very interesting. I'm just wondering. Ashkenazim do not. No. Yeah. No, but I'd like to see. Sometimes these minhagim survive in attenuated ways. Meaning, the original minhag was they actually said a bracha. It was a bracha on the haftorah of ksuvim. Now that's gone by the wayside. We don't do that. And again, I have not traced exactly when that stopped being done, but the Gaonim of Babel didn't like it. They basically said there was only a takana of Haftorah, and indeed, in the Gemara itself, you only see the Haftorah of Nevi'im, you don't see the Haftorah of Ksuvim.
Resonates with this a little bit.
Yeah.
At the end of Mincha on Shabbat, after Aleinu,
Yeah.
They say the first three psukim of the parasha are coming. Yeah. Then the first three psukim of the haftarah, and then three psukim from Kitabim.
Is that okay? So again, what you're going to see is that there are sometimes remnants of old minhagim that are preserved, but they are not the actual minhag as it was, but they are a zecher. In fact, I'll give you an interesting example, which we don't paskin like, but from Chanukah to such a story. You know that Chazal talk about Chanukah as being a holiday that commemorates the miracle of finding a pach hashemen, a little jar of oil that should have burnt only one day, and miraculously it burned 8 days. And Chazal say to commemorate the miracle of the pach hashemen, we have a holiday of Chanukah. But if you go back to the apocryphal books, you go back to the Sefer HaMakkabim, and what's fascinating is, in the book of the Maccabees, there is, not only is that not given as the reason for Chanukah, but in fact, that nace is not even mentioned. It doesn't even mention the nace of the Pach HaShemen at all, but it mentions Milchama, it mentions victory of the Nitzachon of the war over Yevanim, which the Rambam mentions as well as the main reason for Chanukah. Hachzaras Ribonot LiYisrael, the return of sovereignty to the Jewish people. But in the Sefer HaMakkabim 2, in Maccabees 2, it mentions a very odd thing. It mentions that Chanukah was made a holiday for 8 days because that year they could not celebrate Sukkos in the Beis HaMikdash, and Sukkos includes Shemini Atzeres. So they made the holiday of Chanukah 8 days as a makeup for Sukkot. And it says in Maccabees 2, they took Lulav and Esrog, this is a serious thing, and dwelt in a Sukkah. Now, in halachic literature, including the Gemara, that is simply ignored because that has no halachic status. If it was such a custom, it was a custom that was not sanctioned by rabbinic Judaism. So that's simply gone. But Lani Asdati, there's a little bit of a remez to this old idea, because if you remember, Beis Shammai says, Beis Hillel says, the Chanukah candles, you go up. Start with one. Beis Shammai says, start with eight and go down. And the reason the Gemara gives is it should correspond with the Korbanos of Sukkos that were brought in a descending order. And the Mefarshim have a lot of problems. What is the shaychus? What is the connection between Chanukah and Sukkot that Beis Shammai, which we don't paskin like, of course, but Beis Shammai is modeling Hadlakas Ner Chanukah on the sacrifices of Sukkot? So it seems to me that this is a little remez, like grass getting through concrete, meaning that even when you try to destroy a certain minhag, there are going to be bits and pieces that pop up. And this is a residual zecher of the idea that Chanukah was originally a substitute for Sukkot, and that is why the Hadlakas HaNeros mirrors the Korbanos of Sukkot. So Chazal didn't like the apocryphal books at all. They do not cite the Book of the Maccabees. They do not use the Book of the Maccabees. It's not heretical. The Book of Maccabees is not heretical per se, but... No. Megillas Antiochus is in the Birnbaum Siddur. That's not the Book of the Maccabees. There are four different historical sources for the miracle of Chanukah. The oldest source is Sefer HaMakkabim or Sefer Chashmonaim. That's the same thing. And that's a big book. That's like four books, actually. Four books. And that's, huh? Well, there's actually four. But okay, you're right. Three and four are not about Chanukah. But there is Sefer HaMakkabim 1, 2, 3, 4, but 1 and 2 are about Chanukah. And in those books, you will get much more detail than you're probably interested in. You'll get a detailed discussion of every battle, every skirmish, all the military strategies, and the like. But you're not going to find the miracle of the Pach HaShemen. That's source number one. Now, source number two is Josephus. Now, Josephus lived more than 150 years after the Chanukah story. You know, he lived at the time of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, but he gives us historical details as well. Source number three is Megillas Tanis, which is already from the Chachamim, around shortly before the Mishnah. But again, and that brings the Pach HaShemen story. And that is what the Gemara quotes in Masechet Shabbos, but that too was written more than 100 years after the Hanukkah story. And the fourth source is called Megillas Antiochus. And that is a short version. That's around, that's in the Birnbaum Siddur. That's a document of around, in the Siddur would be what, 10 pages or something. And some kehilos had a minhag of reading Megillas Antiochus on Shabbos Chanukah or some other day of Chanukah. But Beis HaKnesses, others didn't. But what is strange about Megillas Antiochus is there is widely conflicting and contradictory versions of what this document from when this document dates. Some put it the earliest document, Mamish, contemporaneous with the events. Others put it in the Middle Ages.
Wow.
Right? So it's either just a late medieval reworking. Yeah, yeah. So there are many, many machlokim. So that's not the Book of the Maccabees. The Book of Maccabees is much bigger. You can get a two-volume thing called Sfarim Chitzonim that has the whole Book of the Maccabees plus a lot of other stuff. These are the external books, the Apocrypha.
When did they start to say Haneris Halalu?
Haneris Halalu, they say, is very, very early. That they say may have been...
That's the, yep. You know, we have the conflict between Al-Anisim, which is the battle, and
yep.
Haneris
Halalu. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think people say Al-Hanisim is the early. You know, again, one of the common understandings is that Hanukkah was originally a celebration of military victory, and then it became a celebration, right, right. And then it became a celebration of the spiritual nace.
They started before they had the military victory. They just started winning.
That's correct. They just started winning. That's right. So that is why the Al-Hanisim only emphasizes the military victory, albeit for spiritual reasons. For spiritual reasons, but it emphasizes the military victory, and only later do we bring in the nation. In fact, what is very bizarre, and this I really can't explain, in Josephus's account of Hanukkah. Now Josephus is already after not after the mission, but Josephus is after Megillas Tanis. Josephus seems to have been ignorant that Jews light candles on Hanukkah. He talks about Hanukkah only as a military victory. Not only is he ignorant of the miracle of the oil, he's even ignorant of the ceremony. Because Josephus addresses the question, why is Hanukkah called Chag Ho'urim? Now, if you ask any kid, we light candles, we generate lights. He made up another thing. He says, well, when Jews were victorious in battle, they would carry torches. He made up some reason. And he didn't give the obvious reason that we light candles. So it could very well be that even as late as Josephus, maybe the minhag of lighting Neirot was not so well established yet. In other words, Hanukkah was celebrated as a military victory day, but not a day of Hadlakas HaNeiros, right? So Hanukkah is very interesting in that way. But how did I get onto this? I don't remember. Right? What were we talking about? Okay. Anyone remember? Okay. Okay, but this is the... Oh, yeah, I know why I was telling you. In other words, I had mentioned that under Maseches Sofrim, there was a Haftorah Shabbos Mincha in the Ksuvim. The Gaonim of Bavel blasted that out of the water. Don't do it anymore. But you've mentioned to me different minhagim in which some kesuvim are recited Shabbos Mincha, so it could very well be just that there's a vestige, just as I indicated, that although Chazal severed Hanukkah from Sukkot, but there's a vestige in at least Beit Shammai that such a connection existed. This is very fascinating, that old minhagim might not always survive in their original form, but they don't die. They pop up in one way or the other. Okay, now in terms of Aliyos, the halacha is very, very familiar. Again, some of this is not controversial. Monday, Thursday, Shabbos Mincha, 3 Aliyos. Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed, 4 Aliyos. Chanukah is only 3, by the way. Chanukah is and Chanukah and Purim are 3. Rosh Chodesh, Chol HaMoed is 4. Yom Tov, this is not counting Matkah, Yom Tov is 5. Yom Kippur is 6, and Shabbos is 7, and this raises a very interesting theoretical question, and as people ask, what is the holiest day in the Jewish calendar? So most people would think Yom Kippur is called the Shabbat Shabbason, the Shabbos of Shabboses. And yet you see in the Aliyah of the Torah that Shabbos has seven and Yom Kippur only has six. And in fact, the reason that's given is because if I do malacha on Yom Kippur, I am liable for death in the hands of heaven, but I'm not executed. If I do malacha on Shabbos and I'm warned, I actually get misa bidei adam, and that normally indicates a greater level of severity. So this raises the question, if a Shabbos is holier than Yom Kippur, why is Yom Kippur called the Shabbos of Shabboses? So it's interesting that maybe we're misinterpreting. You know, the Rambam has, when the Rambam talks about the laws of fasting, Tisha B'Av, whatever it is, the Rambam has a section that is called Hilchos Tanis, the laws of fasting. When the Rambam discusses the fast of Yom Kippur, he invents a new title that is called Hilchos Shevisas Asor. This is really made up by the Rambam. Shevisas Asor meaning the laws of resting on the 10th day. Which means the Rambam understands that fasting on Yom Kippur is not a matter of affliction or suffering. It is a matter of transcending the physical to become like an angel. And therefore the Rambam lumps together not doing malacha and fasting as both of them are forms of refraining from my interaction with the physical environment. One way I refrain is not eating, not drinking. And the other way I refrain is not doing malacha. So instead of saying there's fasting and not doing malacha, the Rambam connects the two concepts by calling it shevisa. You are refraining from physicality. Now, based on that idea, we simply could say this. Shabbos Shabboson is not a reference to holiness. It simply says, this is the Shvisa of the Shvisa. Because a normal Shabbat, I'm only Shovet Mimlacha, and not from Achila. Here, I am Shovet. In fact, that might be the source of why the Rambam invented this expression. Shabbat Shabbaton, that everything about Yom Kippur is Shvisa. Now that's very significant, because that indicates that the fast of Yom Kippur is not intended to be a painful deprivation. It is intended to be transcending the physical. That might be why there's a specific mitzvah in the Torah to eat before Yom Kippur, because we don't want you to suffer. In other words, we want you to feel okay. So the obvious question is, this is a wonderful thought. This is the difference in Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av, suffer. Yom Kippur, transcend. That's why people ask, should you wish somebody at Tzom Kal? So it could be, for Tisha B'Av, you don't wish at Tzom Kal. You're supposed to have at Tzom Kasher. But Yom Kippur, Tzom Kal. But the question is, you know, the question you'll ask is the obvious. Right.
Among the English speakers, we say have a meaningful fast.
Meaningful, yeah, that's right. I thought we invented that in Silver Spring. But okay, yeah, that's a good expression. Okay. That is a good expression. So the thing is, everything's wonderful. I understand conceptually it fits, but the Torah doesn't describe it that way. The Torah says, Ta'anu es nafsho seichem. Ta'anu means afflict your soul. Suffer. Ta'anu is an inui. So the answer has to be that inui of the nefesh is not the same thing as inui to the person. The nefesh is understood as a person's animal soul. So what we're saying is, deny your animal soul its normal pleasure. So the animal soul is munah, but you as a total entity transcends, right? Tanu es nafsho seichem. Now, I have to say that this is not accepted by all writings. I mean, in certainly in some of our tefillos, there is a certain resonance that may the suffering that I'm going through be an atonement. I mean, there certainly is references in Piyutim to the notion of Yom Kippur as a day of affliction and suffering. But even that is all transcendence, meaning you're not, in other words, this is really a brilliant, brilliant insight that the Rambam is formulating just by the use of his terminology. He does not call Yom Kippur a tanis. He calls Yom Kippur a shavisa, a refraining. And he lumps it together with malacha because we're supposed to be angelic. We're not supposed to be connected to the physical world. And refraining from eating is simply a reflection that I am not connected to the physical universe that I normally inhabit. So that's why I'm saying Shabbat Shabbaton is not referring to dargot of holiness. It is referring to double refraining, which Shabbos doesn't have. Yeah.
Is the idea also that there's a difference between Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur?
Yeah.
In that on Yom Kippur, you refrain from eating.
Yes.
But on Tisha B'Av, you also have to refrain from learning. So when you talk about in Yom Kippur, it's only the nefesh. But our Bishop of the Neshama, and there's this, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein came home at Motzei Tisha B'Av and sat down to learn, and someone asked him, "Don't you want to eat something?" And he said,
"I was starving."
The Neshama has also been starved and needs to be fed.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
As a matter of fact, heard the story, and I once asked him, I said, "Is this apocrypha that you said this?"
Yeah.
He said, "It's not apocrypha."
It's not apocrypha. that was a little chutzpah on your part, but okay.
I was checking whether
it was Torah. Okay.
So, but the idea is that on Tisha B'Av you have to afflict your neshama and your nefesh, and on Yom Kippur only.
That's right. That's right. It's only the animal soul because essentially you're separating yourself from the animal instincts that are within us.
Because on Tisha B'Av we lost both the physical aspect of and the spiritual aspect.
Right. Very good. So basically you see from this halacha of Kriyas HaTorah that Shabbos is a higher sanctity than even Yom Kippur. Because Yom Kippur is 6 olim, not counting the maftir, and Shabbos is 7 olim. Now what's interesting is, what about Hosafos? Are you allowed to add extra aliyahs? Now some shuls go crazy, I don't know what they're in Hagim in the Shtiblecha about Hosafos and the like, but other shuls add, Hasidim often will add every
Shira, everybody gets an aliyah.
Right. So according to Maseches Sofrim, we are not allowed to make Hosafos on Monday, Thursday, Shabbos Mincha, Rosh Chodesh, or Chol HaMoed, right? But on Yom Tov and Shabbos, we're allowed to have Hosafos. Now, it's interesting that the minhag of many shuls is they will allow Hosafos on Shabbos and not on Yom Tov. It's not clear what the source is, because the source of Hosafos here does equate Yom Tov and Shabbos. But it's complicated. I'm going to get a little ahead of myself. I'll just start this. Because when you make a Hosafa, you have to, again, obviously the Gaboim know this very, very well. There are only certain places you're allowed to stop. You know, in the Torah, we have paragraph divisions. Sometimes they're called pesuchos, open paragraphs. Sometimes they're called stumos. A pesucha is when a paragraph ends in the middle of a line, and you leave the rest of the line blank, and you begin the next parsha on the next line. That's called psucha because the line is left open. A satuma is when you begin on the same line after a gap of 9 letters. And this is an extremely important halacha. You might think it's a minor thing. If you don't have your psuchos and stumos right, even if all the letters are perfect, the Sefer Torah is puzzle. We are stricter with psuchos and stumos than we are with even misspellings of words. Sometimes misspellings might be accepted if it doesn't, or an extra letter might be accepted if it doesn't change the meaning. Psuchos and stumos, which don't change the meaning at all, the Torah is absolutely puzzle. So there are rules that you cannot end an aliyah if you're not leaving over 3 psukim to the end of the parsha, and you cannot end an aliyah within 3 psukim of the beginning of a parsha. So you have to be sure that if you end an aliyah, there's at least 3 verses till the end of the paragraph, or if you go into the next paragraph, you read at least 3 verses. That's going to create a dilemma when you're Parsha is only 5 psukim because you literally have no place to stop. You can't stop after 3 because you're leaving over 2. And in order to leave over 3, you'd have to stop after 2, right?
So
you have to, in other words, there's no way. A parsha of 5 psukim cannot by itself be split with two aliyahs.
What parsha has on the
left? And when I say parsha, I'm not referring to parsha, I'm referring to paragraph. The word parsha is really referring to the paragraphs. Mm-hmm. And
why can't you start one pasuk?
No, that's what you do. In fact, we're going to see. We're going to see that this is exactly the Rosh Chodesh problem. We'll talk about that at great length. And then there are, so those are the halachos. The halachos are, an aliyah has to have three verses, number one, and you can't stop an aliyah less than three verses from the end of a paragraph, even if you're going to continue, and you can't stop an aliyah less than three verses from the beginning of a parsha. No connection. In other words, in other words, it makes no difference if it's psucha or stuma. These halachas are the same in both. Oh no, you absolutely could. No, that's the best place to stop. The best place to stop is at the end of a paragraph. No, that's for sure. But if you're stopping in the middle, you gotta be sure that you've read three verses and you're leaving three verses. Yeah. If you want to stop at the end of a psucha stuma, that is perfect. That's the ideal place to stop. Now, those are halachos. Now, we then have minhagim, that we don't like to stop at a bad place, and we don't like to begin in a bad place. Now, there's something that talks about the death of the Jews, or the destruction of the Jews, or a sin. Now, this does have a makor in Maseches Sofrim, although not as general a concept. Maseches Sofrim mentions that whoever gets the aliyah of the tochacha, the curses, we don't split it among two olim, because we don't want the second Oleh to begin with curses. So the Oleh starts reading, or the Balkari starts reading a few verses before the curses, and it goes into a few verses after the curses. So that is a general idea, that we don't want to end with curses, and we don't want to begin with curses. But Maseches Sofrim doesn't apply it across the board, but based on that, the minhag is fairly widespread. You never want to begin an aliyah or end an aliyah with a bad note or a negative note against Am Yisrael and the like. Okay, we'll stop here and we'll have a good job. Yeah, that's right. Eichas, all right, that's correct. Yeah, okay.